Chloe Atkins was an active 20-year-old college student when she suddenly became very ill with a mysterious disease. For the next 12 years, Ms. Atkins found herself in and out of hospitals, often fighting for her life, while she also had to battle with medical professionals for a diagnosis and proper treatment. My Imaginary Illness, A Journey into Uncertainty and Prejudice in Medical Diagnosis is published by Cornell University Press, and it brings Chloe Atkins to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So you were a normal, active college student in Canada, and then one summer you became very sick. What happened?
Well, I mean, if I look back, I think there were symptoms that I didn't really pick up. I was getting weaker at different times. My coordination went a bit, but nothing I would have gone to a physician about anyway. But I woke up from an anesthetic that I'd had. I had some abdominal surgery, some sort of keyhole surgery. It wasn't that major. And I woke up blind and paralyzed and not breathing very well from that.
So that's rather drastic. What was the first reaction of doctors?
Well, they were actually very good. I mean, they thought perhaps that I'd had a stroke, and so they did a CT scan and they did investigations, but nothing really bore out. And so unbeknownst to me, it began to be queried about whether this was in fact psychological in origin. As I said, it was never communicated to me. I only found that out when I looked at the chart months later. And the discharge summary said that I'd had a CVA, which is a cerebral vascular accident, and then something called conversion reaction, which is another word for psychosomatic.
So, and once you get that label, psychosomatic conversion reaction, then every doctor who looks at it from then on says, well, maybe that's the reason.
I mean, it's actually what it is it just harms your case from then on, because really any physical symptom that you then express or complain about can then be seen to be psychosomatic in origin. So it acts as a stigma.
Well, why was it so difficult to get a real diagnosis?
Well, I think in the end I'm being treated for atypical myasthenia gravis, and the incidence.
So the atypical is the word?
The atypical, I have to sort of put that there because I don't qualify under all of the tests for it. But I've gone from being someone who was a quadriplegic and actually needing ventilation. I needed life support at times, couldn't swallow, to someone who's walking around. So the medications work for me. But it's meant to be a rare disease. I think they're realizing it's more common than they realized at first, and that people actually suffocate to death before they realize that, in fact, these people have this illness.
So it's part of the problem, the fact that they have a chart and it says there are 10 things that indicate a person has this illness. This person only has 6 of them, so it can't be that illness?
Yeah, you make a good point, Leonard. I think what it is that we tend to view diagnosis sort of the same way as a table, that it's a fact in front of us, and in fact, it's a theory. The best example I can sort of think of is that we used to think of diabetes as one disease. It's now treated as two diseases. I actually think the whole sort of issue around the liberation treatment for multiple sclerosis may in fact reveal that there are different forms of MS going that are in fact existent.
And then there were ulcers, which everybody said were caused by stress. And now it turns out it's a bacterial infection.
Exactly. And what's interesting, what I think is problematic, is both the medical systems move towards a more humanistic view of medicine and our own psychologizing of medicine.
So what happens if a doctor – I don't want to pick on all doctors, but yeah. If they can't find a real diagnosis – then the next assumption is that we're talking psychosomatic. And doesn't this really happen more with women than with men?
Well, I mean, I think it does. It happens for two reasons. One is women have more contact with physicians. So just in terms of mathematically, that's going to happen. And so also women are sort of seen as more emotionally labile and less sort of, strong than men. And so that, I think, happens. There are cultural norms that slip in. But I also think there is this idea that we are beginning more humanistic. We're thinking of the mind-body connection. The problem is the system is not set up that way. So if you don't qualify as having physical symptoms, you're now the purview of psychiatry, and there's a wall between them.
Well, in the early days of psychiatry, psychiatrists like Freud were dealing with a condition called hysteria.
Which is
named after a woman. Hysteria means womb, doesn't it?
Right, yeah.
So only women were hysterical, and this was a psychological condition?
Yeah, it was a psychological condition. But also, actually, funnily enough, things like shell shock, Gulf War syndrome. I mean, actually, veterans get sort of typecast as that as well? So it has actually affected young men as well.
Well, once a patient has become diagnosed with something, how difficult is it to officially change the diagnosis?
I think it's virtually impossible. And I even once I began, people began to suspect because I was so ill. I was, as I said, I was on life support and totally paralyzed, almost locked in. People began to realize that, in fact, there must be something physically wrong. It was very difficult to dislodge it politically. And even at this point, as I said, I have to sort of say atypical myasthenia gravis in case there's somebody out there who doesn't want to say that I have typical myasthenia gravis.
Wasn't it even suggested that you were willing your own death?
Oh, absolutely. There's sort
you,
of
a, you had to be really crazy.
Well, either that or I had to be a yogi. I mean, so that I was reducing my oxygen saturations and causing my heart to falter. So, you know, I was either extraordinarily powerful or I was crazy. And what was interesting is that that physicians conflate the two, that they conflate malingering and psychosomatic. So although it's meant to be unconscious, that you're unconsciously doing it, they began to treat me as always consciously doing it.
Although you had no past history of this sort of thing.
No, but you don't need that.
Your experience was mostly with the Canadian medical system, but didn't you come to the United States to see a specialist?
Yeah, I was hospitalized here, and I also sought extra help down here. I had actually hoped that a private system would give me more choice and that I'd have more control and that perhaps I would get to the bottom of it. What I actually found is that the medical culture in both places is about the same, and I found physicians treated me with disdain here as much as they did in Canada. They just asked me to pay up for it. So there were good physicians here, and there were good physicians in Canada at about the same rate. There was really no difference. But the other thing I should say is that the fact that I went undiagnosed meant that I got very ill. I cost at least the medical system a great deal of money. This was impractical. And I really think this, in part, I wrote the book. It's a memoir. We're talking theoretically here. It just tells the story. But I just think there's a real urgency. There are a lot of people who don't know, who get diagnosed with sort of stress-related disorders. And I think dismissing them is not the way to go.
What about you? Did you ever wonder whether it was in your head?
Of course I did. I mean, I was so ill that I really wanted to do everything possible. So I did years of psychotherapy in an effort to, in a sense, embrace the diagnosis of psychosomatic illness. And it didn't make me better. It certainly helped me cope with an incredibly disabling condition, but it didn't improve me. I don't regret it, but it wasn't the answer.
Well, you mentioned that the only difference between the way you were treated by doctors here and in Canada was that you had to pay more money here.
Yeah.
But the Canadian system and the American system have become a part of the healthcare debate in this country.
Yeah.
You want to weigh in?
Well, I mean, I'm biased. I've lived in both countries. I am very grateful I'm in the Canadian system because it hasn't bankrupted me. I've had extraordinary care in the sense that I've had to be in intensive care several times. And that's very expensive. Now I'm getting very good care from the province I'm in. They are doing a lot of preventative care, which is good. And so I'm costing them a lot less money. I'm grateful that I would have been bankrupt here, and I'm not sure I actually would have survived because I might have well have been turned away as being uninsured here.
Well, people would say, critics of the Canadian system would say that some of the problems you face was because of the overburdened medical system there.
No, I think both systems are pretty overburdened, having been in both of them. At least I had access. And as I said now, I found the level of care to be comparable. Really.
Do you think that if you'd gone to Germany or France or England or some other country, that you would have had any much of a different experience?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, for instance, France has more liver diseases. England has more kidney diseases. So, I mean, every country has its own sort of cultural diagnostic frame. But I think this happens a lot in what we call allopathic medicine, where, you know, you don't quite fit the diagnostic paradigm. So I think it could have happened anywhere.
My guest is Chloe G.K. Atkins. Her book, My Imaginary Illness, A Journey into Uncertainty and Prejudice in Medical Diagnosis. It also has a clinical commentary by Brian David Hodges, who's an MD, and a foreword by Bonnie Blair O'Connor. So how did you finally wind up being diagnosed correctly?
One physician floated the idea of myasthenia gravis and then dismissed it. I was fortunate because I was a young academic. I was a doctoral student, and I had access to medical journals, and we began to investigate it more, and we probed it, and it seemed like it was a fit.
So what is typical myasthenia gravis?
Well, typical myasthenia gravis would mean that I would fit all three sort of diagnostic tests, and I only test positive on two. what's interesting is I'm hearing back from readers every day, which is rather extraordinary, of stories of people who are much the same as I am that don't particularly qualify in all.
Some doctors just make the leap and treat them for myasthenia gravis?
And they're very fortunate that that happens because a lot of physicians are unwilling to make the leap. And I'm even acutely aware now that if, for instance, I were to have a crisis, get weaker and need medical care, that I might run across a physician who just says, no, I don't want to deal with it.
Well, you never did pursue getting an official diagnosis. Why?
Well, I don't really see the point. We know that I test positive on two of the three tests. There's no point in retesting on a test that's going to keep coming up negative. I think really the model of the disease needs to be sort of advanced, and I think it is happening. I hear from researchers it is, and maybe at that point we'll get a more sort of confirmed diagnosis. But it's at the moment I'm working with physicians who feel this is a good enough working diagnosis. It's keeping me well. We carry on with it.
Well, you said that you were in pretty bad shape. You needed help breathing.
Yeah.
You were pretty much paralyzed.
Well, my worst point was I could only move a muscle on my left wrist to communicate. I couldn't open my eyes even though I was conscious. I was on a ventilator. I had not swallowed for weeks, so I was on tube feeding. I was very, very ill.
Is that when you got the unofficial diagnosis?
Sort of. It took actually a few months. One group of physicians said, yes, I had it. Another said I didn't.
When did they just try treating you for it and hope for the best?
It became very politically difficult, actually, because some physicians, what would happen is one physician would on his shift agree to treat, and then in the next round would run across a physician who did not want to treat and therefore prescribe the medications for it, which are fairly toxic. So there was a political battle that began to be waged over my care.
But eventually all of your doctors came together.
Eventually.
What brought them together?
Really actually changing locale made the huge difference, actually. I ended up away from the city where I'd originally spent a great deal of time as a hospitalized patient and sort of got a restart, and that was helpful.
Well, this is a toxic treatment for people who don't have the illness, or is there a toxic side? Do you have terrible side effects?
There are side effects, no matter what.
I mean, because you look great right now.
Well, thank you.
Well, you know, obviously you're not in a wheelchair. You don't have a respirator.
Exactly. I mean, I've really been given a second chance at life. I mean, the issue is that what it does is it suppresses the immune system. It's the same medications you'd use for a transplant patient. And so there are toxicities associated with that long term.
As a layperson reading this book, I was alarmed by the lack of compassion that was shown by many of the doctors that you write about. I guess they don't teach compassion in medical school.
Well, I mean, the issue for me, I was really clear. I didn't want to laud or vilify anybody about this. What I began to realize that there was no one person responsible because this was a cultural response on both sides of the border in medicine. This was something to do with the system and the way people worked. So what I really wanted to do was to try and wonder why people who really wanted to do the very best for me were treating me so badly. What was inherent there? What was the problem there?
Well, to some degree, this is a communication problem. And if you can communicate well with a doctor who's willing to listen, you're more likely to come to some kind of a conclusion, aren't you?
I think it is about communication. It's also about relationship. And the problem is there are time constraints. There are systemic constraints. And there are actually even architectural ones in the hospital that make it difficult for some of these things to take place so that there's real communication between a physician and patient. I've actually always sort of proposed a study that I'd like to do, and maybe it actually might happen, is where we have a chart that's getting data. In other words, there's x-rays coming back and blood tests, but there's no patient. And I'd like to see how long it takes a clinician to sort of stop and everything and say, okay, look, this patient has been out down for a smoke or out down to x-ray, and I don't want to do anything more until I meet him or her and speak to him or her and examine her. And I think it might take a while for some clinicians.
Well, this is a problem in a lot of different areas. Recently, I moderated a town hall meeting on spinal cord injuries, and the complaint that the injured had was that the scientists are working at the bench and they're very committed to coming up with all sorts of solutions, but they don't talk to the people who they're actually trying to help. often enough anyway. In fact, the feeling was not at all. And somebody said, well, it's better in Canada. And then somebody popped up and said, oh, I'm from Canada. It's no better in
no,
Canada.
No, I mean, it isn't really. And in fact, there are other things I can say that I'm grateful I'm in the Canadian system for medical care. But in fact, your accessibility for a disabled person down here is much better in the U.S. And I used to love coming here in my wheelchair to New York because there were accessible buses. And I mean, it's vastly superior in other areas. But yeah, I do think there is this lacuna, this gap between where the researchers are and even physicians. I mean, as I said, the physician tends to treat the diagnostic category as a thing, as an entity in itself, and doesn't say when there's an odd symptom, well, that's curious. I wonder what that means. They just dismiss it and say, right, well, that can't be. And therefore, either the patient's crazy or this diagnosis doesn't work.
Now, often in situations like this, a parent or a loved one, a family member will advocate for the person involved. Did you not have anybody like that?
I didn't originally. I was estranged from my parents, which can happen when you're a young adult. I later have family. I have a very supportive family now. I have a spouse and 4 children. And my spouse works in healthcare. I mean, I've actually heard, I was vilified in the sense that I was seen as psychosomatic because my parents weren't there. I've actually had readers come to me and say, well, my parents were really supportive and it was seen as though I was trying to go, milk that attention more. So I think it's sort of like a horoscope. You know, you can sort of get it to fit anything, the psychosomatic diagnosis, that you can make sort of social and emotional circumstances fit it. And so that's one of its dangers. And as I said, I think it's problematic.
So you've gone on to become a professor specializing in bioethics. You probably wouldn't have gone into the field if you hadn't had this experience.
You're absolutely right. When I got better, part of me just wanted to leave this experience behind. It gradually dawned on me that I'd experienced an extraordinary sort of level of vulnerability that most people never return from or recover from, and that I had a moral responsibility to talk about it and to speak about what that was like and what we could maybe do for people in those positions.
Well, you deserve an award for the guest who went to the most trouble to get here. You drove 10 hours from Canada to come
show? Well, it was yesterday. I passed through immigration twice in this country. I was on a plane in Toronto for 2.5 hours on the tarmac. We couldn't get here. Had to pass back out of immigration. I got a rental car and I drove down last night.
What about the medications? You're still taking them?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Will you ever be able to get off of them?
No, and in fact, unfortunately, they're increasing. I mean, they have side effects. I have high blood pressure. I'm getting more swollen. I'm breaking bones, so I have a couple of broken vertebrae from it. I mean, there are. I knew there would be costs, and I'm paying them now a bit. But without them, I wouldn't be breathing or walking around. So, you know, I'm actually pretty grateful for what I've got.
There is a problem with an illness like myasthenia gravis in that it isn't that common. I think it's 1 in 250,000 people, which is still a fair number of people, but not enough for drug companies to go out there and say, we're going to find the cure and we're going to come up with something that isn't going to have all these terrible side effects.
You're absolutely right. I mean, one thing I think I'm lucky about is I have arrived, at a moment in history where it sort of can be treated. And it could not well have been the case. I might have had a disease that couldn't be treated. But you're right. There isn't much work being done because there are not very many people who have it. There's not much pressure. But as I said, I am fortunate in the sense that unlike a disease like MS or ALS, there is something that sort of manages it. It does fluctuate. It's not perfect. Excuse me. So,
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Chloe G.K. Atkins, her book, My Imaginary Illness, A Journey into Uncertainty and Prejudice in Medical Diagnosis, with clinical commentary by Brian David Hodges and a foreword by Bonnie Blair O'Connor. The book is published by, I'm losing your publisher, it is Cornell University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.